Okay, because I only reserved the room for you guys for 2 meetings, so...
Call it. Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order for Wednesday, the 25th of February, and open a work session for the purpose of introducing some committee bills. Somebody have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do.
Representative Nose.
Chair Greenlink, I move the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC 3617, dated February 17, 2015. LC 2411, dated, it's like October 28th, 2014, and LC 2512, also dated October 21st, 2014.
Thank you, Representative Nose. Representative Nose moves we adopt the following LCs as committee bills. LC 3617, dated 2-17-15. LC 2411, dated 10-28-14. LC 2512, dated 10-21-14. I remind you all that by introducing these bills as committee bills, we in no way endorse them, recommend them, or maybe even wonder if they'll come back to us. But is there any discussion about the LCs? Is there any objection to admitting them as committee bills? So moved. Close the work session. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2395, and likely we'll open a work session to follow to move this bill on. Let's do a few things to it. Let's see. Can we call Sean Comer? Sean, who will you bring with for the opening panel? Do you want to tell us what this bill is about?
Sure. Mr. Chair, House Bill 2395 extends the hospital assessment from September 30th, 2015 to September 30th, 2017, declares an emergency effective on passage. There are amendments, and our panel is Sean Comer, Dave Underreiner, and Martin Taylor.
Yeah, and I can say in advance, I've been involved in working with the governor's office and other members of the House and Senate, and the speaker in the president's office, and I think we'll be hearing a report that we have pretty much agreement from everybody on this bill, and it will move forward. Sean, you start. Who's starting?
I'll start. So, thank you, Chair Greenlink, and members of the committee. My name's Dave Underreiner, and I'm actually chair of the board of the Oregon Hospital Association and Health Systems, and also on the board of the Oregon Health Leadership Council, and am the CEO of Providence Health and Services here in Oregon. And I'm here to talk about the bill and just some components of it, and we'll really have Sean go into a little bit more detail. Just the reminder, the Oregon Health Leadership Council and leaders in the executive branch have worked together in a public-private collaboration to develop the 2015-17 budget and for Medicaid and the Medicaid package. Members of the working group include the COOs, insurers, hospitals, representatives from the governor's office, and experts from OHA, so a very collaborative group. The goal is to develop a financing framework, budget recommendation, and policy package to fund the Oregon Health Plan for the biennium 2015-17. And House Bill 2395 contains the policy and tax portions of those discussions. The hospital tax is being proposed to be extended for 4 years under House Bill 2395, a provision that, when combined with all other components of the package, is supported by the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Services. Levied on 28 DRG, or diagnostic-related group hospitals, the tax and federal government matching funds currently fund about 23% of the Oregon Medicaid program. While the tax has been, and for the next 4 years will continue to be, a significant source of financing, it's important to note that it cannot fully fund the program alone. Other federal funds, general funds, and tobacco master settlement agreement resources are necessary to adequately fund the program for the coming biennium. And we will need to work collaboratively to find solutions for the next biennium as well. Established in 2013, the Hospital Transformation Performance Pool, or HTTP, is an important component to continue to incentivize and reward performance against metrics designed to drive transformation. The fund is generated through an additional 1% tax matched by federal funds. House Bill 2395 extends the HTTP for an additional 4 years and ensures an even split of those resources between hospitals and CCOs. The important policy components contained in House Bill 2395 are only a part of the full Medicaid funding package. The other critical piece is full funding of the package in the OHA budget, Senate Bill 5526. While that bill is currently in the purview of Ways and Means, it is essential to talk about both pieces of the package together. Full funding of the package, including $1.1 billion of state funds, enables us to continue to provide quality care to Oregon's Medicaid recipients. For Providence, this work is fundamental to our work and our values and our mission of serving the poor and vulnerable in our communities while working to create healthier communities together.
Let's have all three witnesses, and then we'll have questions of the panel. I expect we'll have a few.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for having me here today. For the record, my name is Martin Taylor, and I'm here representing Care Oregon. Care Oregon has a relationship with four of the CCOs in Oregon, and we serve about 250,000 Medicaid members, so it's about a quarter of the Medicaid population. We are committed to bringing down the cost of health care and staying within the 3.4% Obama cap while improving health and making sure that we have a local voice in how the Medicaid system works. Care Oregon is a member of the Oregon Health Leadership Council, was an active participant in the development of this 2015-2017 Medicaid funding package, and we believe for coordinated care organizations, the policy agreements and funding components of this package will enable us to continue moving forward with transformation and to serve the hundreds of thousands of Oregonians that receive the Oregon Health Plan benefit. So this bill includes a number of important components. Some have already been mentioned by Mr. Unterreiner, but it includes the hospital tax extension, the hospital tax transformation pool, and now the inclusion of CCOs in that transformation pool. All of these provisions, combined with the full funding of House Bill 5526, which I'm confident will take place later in the session, create a package that will enable CCOs to continue the important work that we do into the future biennium. And with that, I'll end my testimony.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, Sean Colmer, Governor's Office. I think both my co-presenters here did a great job of sort of setting the stage of what how the package got developed, the coalitions that are supportive of the package, and I'll walk you through the -4 amendment of the bill that I think represents that agreement that we have today. So if you look at page 1, lines 8 through 18 of the amendment, essentially that creates a 4-year program. So the program that we currently have today, extend that for 4 years. On page 2, lines 23 through 30, it allocates the 1% of the hospital tax, one to continue the hospital transformation performance pool, and the other to fund the quality metrics that the CCOs are accountable for today, so a split 50-50. On page 3, section 8, it just, again, reaffirms that this is a federal-state conversation. We have to have a conversation with our federal partners around this program. And then as we conclude those conversations, we will notify the legislature that we've concluded those. So that's just an accountability for us to make sure that you all are really clear on where we are and where we are in the process. And lastly, on page 3, Section 9, it creates stability in the contracting policy between CCOs and hospitals. So for those of you who've been around a little while, it's called the par-non-par rate. And that essentially creates a negotiating frame for hospitals and CCOs. It's been a very successful policy to date, and that repeals the sunset that was currently on the par-non-par rates moving forward. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll end my testimony. Hope you support the -4 amendments and move the bill today.
I would just note something that you didn't note, that this is different in dealing with most taxes in that the taxes, the assessment is on the gross revenue of the hospitals. It comes in, it is matched with federal money to help support the Medicaid program, and then that money is returned not to individual hospitals but to the hospital group as a whole to be distributed among hospitals. So it would be great if the federal income tax was that way. I'd be happy to pay it and get it back. Maybe MASH should have an army or something on the way to get it to me. But so, I mean, this is a very unusual kind of circumstance, and it's been going on since, I think, my first term, 2003, if I remember correctly.
Correct.
Are there questions of the panel?
Hayden.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. One comment, not really a question. I've been involved with the provider tax group that's been meeting on pushing this forward, and one comment just for the record is that my observation was that there may be not quite enough help to stabilize our rural hospitals, our A and B hospitals. While they're not part of the package as we move forward with this bill, whether that's today or in the future, there is a group of us working to help for a package to stabilize the small rural provider out in our rural communities, the veteran and the A&B hospital. So, you know, hopefully that can be looked at as more a comprehensive package in the future as we move forward. Thank you.
Great. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. I appreciate everyone working so hard to reach agreement here. And a couple of you alluded to a problem maybe in the next biennium where we have a shortfall. And a couple questions in regard to that. How much of a shortfall do you foresee in the next biennium?
Chair Greenlake, Representative Bueller, the only funding stream that's going away in 17-19 is the last bit of the $1.9 billion that we had, and that's $200 million in this biennium. So that's, at minimum, the challenge that we're going to face.
That's in the more than biennium. A bit, 200.
Correct, yeah. But that's at least what we know today. And a lot of that is going to be driven by caseload. And the sort of ramp down of the ACA expansion match rate. So right now they're 100% federally funded. The last 6 months of this biennium, we begin to pick up a portion of that. And then by 2020, we pay 10% of that group.
And how much is that estimated to be? So you have $200 million from the negotiated money, but then you have the step down from the ACA. So how much is that combined to leave that you estimate?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, I don't know the answer off the top of my head for 17-19, but I'd be more than happy to have a conversation with you about
17-19.
For 17-19, yes, that's what he's talking about. Yeah. Be more than happy to talk to you about it. Yep.
And is there a plan to come up with a way to finance that looking forward?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, there's not a plan right now. I think everybody was hoping to fully fund the program here and do this quickly and then begin the conversation for full funding and stable funding for the Medicaid program moving forward.
And who's going to have that conversation?
Hopefully everybody in this room.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair, it's on the agenda of the Health Leadership Council. Are there other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is this one we have to change one of the?
Yes,
okay.
Yes, it is.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2395 and open up a work session on House Bill 2395. Representative Notes, are you the one with the script?
I am, Mr. Chair.
Okay, go for
it. You ready?
Yep.
Okay, Chair Greenlick, I move to adopt the -4 amendments dated February 20, 2015.
Representative Notes moves to adopt the -4 amendments, as we heard discussed, dated
February 20, 2015.
Is there any discussion on that motion? No objection. Hearing no objection, it's moved into the bill. We now have an amended.
Railroad.
We have House Bill 2395 amended with a -4.
I think I need to make another motion.
Let's have it.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2395 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and then a subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue rescinded and the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
You have that written down here.
I do. Are you kidding? Santa doesn't let me drive the car just yet.
All right. Representative Nose moves that we refer House Bill 2395 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue be rescinded, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Any comments?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I'll be voting to send it to Ways and Means, but reserving the right to possibly vote no on the floor. So,
great.
Depending upon what comes out of Ways and Means and everything else.
Thank you. Any other? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Bueller?
Yes.
Representative Clem?
Is Representative Clem not with us?
No.
Excused.
Representative Kennemer?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Dyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Wagner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wilk?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries. House Bill 2395 moves on to Ways and Means. Close the work session on House Bill 2395 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2222. What have we got here, Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have House Bill 2222. It requires the superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital to establish and implement a program to provide relief healthcare staffing positions for assisting with services during heavy workloads and for staff that are temporarily absent. And we have two individuals here, Mr. Chair.
Please, did you call the first panel?
Okay.
The only panel?
The only panel. Stacy Cowan and Eva Ripito.
This has a subsequent referral, does it not?
Oh, it does, Mr. Chair. Yes, Ways and Means. I apologize.
Thank you, Chair Greenlake and members of the committee. My name is Eva Ripito. Thanks for that. And I represent AFSCME, Oregon AFSCME, as a political coordinator. Thanks so much for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2222 today. AFSCME represents the nurses at the Oregon State Hospital. I wanted to say a little, I know we're just hearing 2222 right now, but also on the agenda today is 2577, and both are attempts to address issues that the nurses have identified and would like to help resolve, mostly around staffing and reduction of violence.
Need to open a hearing on that as well. You can comment
sure.
on that.
Yeah, because she's there.
I'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2755.
Thanks, Chair Greenleak. Again, Eva Ripito, AFSCME. While I know that Oregon State Hospital has been working to reduce violence and know that there has been a reduction, we believe that the conversation should still continue, and we wanted to continue to look for solutions. The last data I was provided is from July 2014, and there were 14 incidences where another patient or a staff person received a moderate injury. And a moderate injury is major soreness, an injury that requires medical treatment but not hospitalization, and it doesn't impair you from doing your daily activities. Also reported in July, there were 18 patients involved in two or more aggressions, with three of those patients having between 8 and 11 incidences, and most patients are four or fewer aggressions in that month. So House Bill 2222, AFSCME originally brought this idea forward in 2013. It was at the time, we wanted to take a portion of the huge overtime budget and use that to hire permanent float pool staff. And what the nurses envisioned wasn't necessarily a traditional float pool, but more of, as one good representative said to me yesterday, a rapid response team. They might be able to fill a traditional role where they have set hours, but not necessarily a set unit that they're assigned to, and that they could respond if staffing was needed. When I was on a tour of the state hospital, I saw firsthand an incident where this would have been helpful. A group of patients was being transferred from the class time to lunchtime, and it was a pretty large group, and one of the patients said, "I can't get on the elevator. I just can't do it. There are too many people." And she was able to say, "Look, through my treatment, I've been able to get to the point where I'm comfortable with 10 or fewer patients or 10 or fewer people in an elevator, but this is just too many." And she was starting to get worked up, and the staff did a great job of keeping her calm and talking her through it and then trying to figure out, okay, so what do we do? We only have two staff people that are transferring this group, and we need two more staff people to either take this one person or split the group or whatever. Fortunately, two nurses that were on their way to lunch happened to come by and were able to help out and take the patient separately. So it was that kind of situation that really is the example of how if we had the float pool, they could call staff, the float pool staff, and say, "Hey, can you come help us? We have somebody who's getting worked up and just needs a little bit extra help for a moment." And then that keeps them from, you know, getting more and more worked up and then eventually lashing out. So during the discussions about the bill, it was brought up that temporary employees were being used to fill the role of float pool, and then not necessarily as the nurses were envisioning, like the example I just gave, but more of a traditional, you know, in absences. But so temporary workers are limited to their status to 6 to 12 months, 6 months in a 12-month period. For those temporary employees who wish to continue working, they can apply, and then they're offered limited duration positions, which I believe are limited to 18 months. Then if the employee wishes to continue on, they can apply for a full-time or a permanent position, and then they have a 6-month probationary period through at that point, too. When talking with AFSCME represented nurses about the staffing, they did acknowledge that things have been improving, and but there is still a high dependency on the temporary and limited duration workers. And this creates high turnover, and they feel like we should be continuing this conversation. The patients at Oregon State Hospital deserve staff that have training and expertise needed to help them heal. It seems like there would be some cost savings for the hospital to hire people permanently and get them trained once and cut down on the potential of having to retrain new employees every 6 to 24 months. So AFSCME is asking that the legislators support appropriate permanent staffing at the state hospital. So speaking of the training, this leads me to the HB 2577, which is on the collaborative problem solving.
755.
Oh, sorry. Mixed it up. Thank you for the correction. So last September, Representative Williamson met with some of our nurses at the state hospital, and they were just beginning this program called collaborative problem solving. The nurses were really excited and hopeful that this would reduce violence, you know, by learning how to, you know, get to the core of the problem instead of just being more of an authority figure working with the patient. The biggest worry was that that not enough staff would be trained in the program, or that there wouldn't be enough funding to continue the program. So AFSCME is very supportive of these efforts, and we wish would like for the collaborative problem solving to become to be funded, and would like any legislation to also include a report back to the legislature every 6 months on the progress of getting staff trained and if and how the program is helping to reduce violence at the state hospital. So thanks so much for your time, and sorry I kind of wandered. I welcome any questions.
Ms. Cohen, why don't you, let you testify first, and then we'll get questions on either of the bills.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Stacey Cowan. I'm with SEIU Local 503. We represent nearly 55,000 workers statewide, and that includes approximately 1,600 workers, non-nursing staff, at the state hospital. Staffing and safety continues to be the top concerns for our workers at the state hospital. I'd just like to echo what Eva has outlined. Things absolutely have definitely been trending in the positive direction as we've been talking with our workers. Things have been improving, but folks definitely feel like there's room for more improvement. So that's why I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2222. So we believe a float pool will help alleviate some of those problems and help provide some of that flexibility that's needed to be able to allow staff to move where they're needed throughout the hospital to really supplement the work that's already being done. What we see when we talk to workers at the state hospitals, there's this cycle that happens, and it's really this unfortunate cycle where you have short staffing situations. They lead to unsafe working conditions. Unfortunately, that further leads to higher rates of absenteeism for a variety of reasons, whether it's injuries, whether it's morale issues, whatever that might be. We see a higher rate of absenteeism, which further exacerbates the short staffing issue. We really believe that the money that's being spent currently on the excessive amount of overtime would be much better spent on a pool of permanent workers that, again, can help alleviate some of the overtime to help fill in when you have folks called off for being sick, when you have folks out for training, when you have situations like Eva mentioned that inevitably are going to pop up in a situation in a setting like the state hospital to be able to provide the support that's needed. Again, we would just echo what was stated, that patients truly deserve the best possible setting to get the care they needed, and that includes adequate staffing that's fully supported with all of the safety mechanisms in place that they need. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Stanley, when we're done with our formal business, we'll be organizing a visit for the committee to the state hospital to talk to employees and other folks and patients. It should be very interesting. So. We'll think about that about the 20th of April, something like that. No, June. Yeah. Okay, are there questions of either of these? Yes, Representative Lively.
Mr. Chair, so the question, I guess, is of you, Eva. I hear about this pool and using funds that are now used for overtime, but I'm still unclear of the pool. So are those people full-time employees that are part of the normal rotation? Or I'm still confused of what is being expected or asked here from the standpoint of the hospital.
Yeah. Chair Greenlake, Representative Lively. Yes, the idea was to have a permanent full-time staff that had set hours, but not necessarily a set unit where they were assigned, but that they could respond to an elevated an incident or, you know, if they were a little bit short on numbers, maybe cover lunch or something like that as well. So, yeah, a little bit of a mixture of a traditional float pool, but also with that rapid response piece.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. Chair Green, thank you. So there's quite a few collaborative efforts to help the counties deal with mental health, which I strongly support, and particularly in the 370 population, to be able to keep some of those people out their home county so that they can access mental health concerns there and health care issues. As we push that forward, I think that will be a significant move forward this legislative session, which is a good thing. But how does that balance with if you create a permanent larger pool here, but we're reducing the amount of patients, particularly in the 370 population, and wanting to have them back in the counties? Of course, there's going to be a need for funding there for staffing. I'm concerned that we create a larger funding opportunity here, but if we are successful in what I believe what we're trying to do, we're going to reduce. So is there any look forward that what you're doing now with the reduction in that population into the state hospital, that might balance out okay without making that permanent? That's my concern.
Chair Greenlake, Representative Hayden, I don't have a specific answer for you, but I would guess that, and I can certainly follow up, my understanding is that there is a staffing shortage and that there's a heavy dependency on temporary and limited duration employees to fill this kind of role that we're seeking to be permanent. I also can guess that there are a number of the employees that might be reaching retirement age, too. So I imagine that there's probably a balance. I don't know for sure. These are all guesses. So I would have to do some more follow-up on that. I also know that, even with the focus on community mental health, there's still the need for the state hospital for, you know, immediate attention to get people stabilized. And until we get, until we move to a place where that need isn't there, we'll always need staff that is experienced and well-trained to be able to care for the patients in the way that they need to be cared for. Thank you.
Mr. Roberts, would you like to comment on anything? We'll be happy to. We're hearing how things are improving. It's a good time for you to come and talk.
Good afternoon, and thank you. I'm Greg Roberts.
Didn't mean to sandbag you, but I thought it might be a nice opportunity for you to meet the committee.
Sure. And we're looking forward to the tour, as we discussed. So thank you for inviting me to the table. I'm happy to provide any information about the staffing at the state hospital as the representative was.
Need to identify yourself.
I'm sorry, Greg Roberts. I'm the superintendent of Oregon State Hospital. As has been mentioned, there is a float pool. There has been a float pool at the state hospital for some time. We have 75 positions, I think, at the current time set aside. It's a mixture of temporary employees and limited duration employees, and has been described. They tend to be people who start out as temps, move to limited duration, and then move to full-time positions. It's been a very successful program for us, helping us provide coverage as needed and reducing overtime at the state hospital as well. Our overtime is down about 30%. Compared to just a few years ago. So the float pool has been helpful as well. So I guess this is an issue of whether the float pool are full-time staff versus temporary staff or limited duration staff. So, but we do have an established float pool, and it has helped as described. So regarding the collaborative problem-solving issue, that's also just in the way of factual information. We have now trained about 400 staff at the state hospital in collaborative problem-solving. There are two tiers. Tier one is the introduction to collaborative problem solving. Tier two occurs after 6 months of implementation, so staff who have been trained 6 months ago and then utilize the methodology on their unit come back for tier two training, which then increases their competency. In fact, today we just finished our first group of 75 staff who went through tier two training. It's a bit too soon. We've actually only implemented this in a robust fashion since January of this year. So it's a bit too soon to have data for the committee to talk about aggression reduction, seclusion restraint reduction, which are the aims of the program. But we will have that information after 4 or 5 months of implementation. And in a gut sense kind of way, we know that it's already having a positive effect, but I don't have any firm data to show or claim a trend.
What's your total staffing number?
Total staffing number now, including Junction City, Representative Greenlick, is the total target is 2,100. I think right now we're in about the 1,850 range because we're soon to open Junction City.
So. Representative Buehler, do you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Greenlick. Thanks for bringing this issue to our attention. But I'm puzzled why this wouldn't be more appropriately covered in collective bargaining negotiations.
Representative Greenlick, Representative Buehler, good question, I think. It's possibly
maybe
it should be.
Maybe one of your colleagues there could answer.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Buehler, thanks for the question. We always advise our membership to go through the collective bargaining process first, and that if when something is not resolved in that way and they believe that it is an issue that should be brought forth before the legislature, that is when we're asked to bring something.
Okay. Follow-up question, please.
Yes, go ahead.
Is that not undermining the negotiation process?
Chair Greenlake, Representative Buehler, if our members have gone through the negotiating process and have and believe that something should be handled at the level of the legislature because they haven't been able to go through to handle something through negotiations, this is they ask us to bring things, whether it's issues or resolutions through legislation, through that process.
So what's the purpose of the negotiation? Then you could always trump the negotiation.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Buehler, I don't think that they view this as necessarily trumping. It's another avenue to reach a resolution.
Thank you.
Okay.
Representative, if I can make one more comment, Representative Hayden, asking about the 370 population, you're absolutely correct. We're looking to reduce the 370 population in the hospital, especially for people arrested for misdemeanors. If we're able to be successful in that regard, our plan at this time is to close one unit that currently serves 370 patients and have that unit serve civilly committed patients so that we can begin to resolve the waiting list issue for the state hospitals, typically 25 to 30 people on the waiting list for admission, which in turn affects the psychiatric boarding issue where psychiatric patients are held in emergency rooms waiting for a bed on an inpatient unit. So if the plan is successful, the overall census of the hospital would remain the same, but we'd be serving more civil patients than 370 patients.
Follow-up?
Yes, a brief follow-up, please.
Chair, okay. So my understanding is in Junction City, you don't take the 370. Is that out of a look forward? Is that correct? And is that out of a look forward, hoping that these other in-county projects are successful with reducing that population?
Representative Greenlicker and Representative Hayden, good question. The answer is it's really an issue of where our expertise is. 370 patients are sent to the hospital to be, in effect, restored to competency, restored to the ability to aid and assist their defense attorney. So there's a certain level of competency, skills that staff need that have to do that, and our Forensic Evaluation Services office is located in Salem. They do the final review so that we can testify to the court, and we wanted to keep that concentrated in Salem as opposed to splitting it across two institutions.
Thank you.
About two-thirds of your beds are forensic beds, right?
Representative Greenlick, it's higher. It's actually three-quarters. Yeah, at the present time.
Thank you very much. Thank you, all
Thank you.
Three. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2222 and House Bill 2775. Just to alert people, in terms of a little scheduling problem, we've got a few witnesses on a couple of bills. We're going to move House Bill 2605 to the end of the agenda with the possibility of carrying it over till the next session. So we'll take the next two bills in order, except for 2605. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2295 and ask the administrator what we have here.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2295 is providing for licensing and regulation of anesthesiologist assistants, establishes a January 1, 2016 as the operative date, declares an emergency effective on passage, and then this is the panel.
Why don't you call the first panel, please?
Okay, first panel, Dr. Joanne Jenny, Caleb Hayes, Michael Schneider.
Well, that's sort of everybody to use the time they need, but not any more than the time they need.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Committee on Health. This is my name is Michael Schneider, and I'm a board-certified anesthesiologist assistant.
You're doing fine so far.
From the state of Oregon.
What's your name?
I'm well-trained in semantics as well. And I currently practice in the state of Georgia, where I trained, and I've been practicing now for 3 years under the supervision of an anesthesiologist and alongside other anesthesiologist assistants, as well as a nurse anesthetists in an anesthesia care team model. Currently, I am unable to practice in the state of Oregon, given I'm not able to obtain licensure in the state. And this bill provides regulation and guidelines, as well as licensure, for me to allow to work in the state of Oregon. I chose the anesthesiologist assistant program after finishing a bachelor's degree in engineering and pre-med requirements. I had the option to apply for physician assistant school, anesthesiologist assistant school, physical therapy, and many other allied health programs where you can train as an under to get a master's degree or a doctorate degree. I chose anesthesiology because I enjoy physiology and I enjoy pharmacology. I shadowed my best friend, who's also an anesthesiologist assistant, and he enjoys a wonderful career in the state of Georgia. And my goal is to return up here to the Pacific Northwest and follow in my grandfather's place, who was a physician here on the coast of Oregon. My family is spread out between Portland, Parkdale, Oregon, and the Cannon Beach, Manzanita area. And my grandfather practiced at the Reinhardt Clinic in Wheeler, Oregon.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Greenlick and the committee. My name is Joanne Jenny. I'm a retired anesthesiologist. I'm here to testify and ask for support, strong support, of House Bill 2295. I'm a product of OHSU, both medical school and residency. I taught at San Francisco at UCSF. I practiced clinical anesthesiology at Legacy Emanuel Hospital for over three decades. And I was a volunteer on missions with Project Hope on eight occasions, 2 months at each time. I've also had the experience of two terms on the Oregon Medical Board. And I've been active in both local and national medical committees and organizations. I'm currently serving on the committee, the Common Credentialing Committee, Advisory Committee, to implement the single path credentialing process, which was Senate Bill 604 in last term. The reason I am very strongly asking for support for the AAs to be licensed in Oregon is, number one, we're going to have to address the realization that there's going to be a manpower shortage or a womanpower shortage of practitioners in Oregon as the anesthesia practitioners retire, get burned out, or as the CCOs grow and we have more patients and more cases to take care of. We also want to meet the triple aim. And also down the line, we're going to be introduced to the perioperative surgical home, which is the next step when the patient has to go to the hospital. And we're going to need streamlined admission, testing, management of the procedures, recovery room, discharge planning. And the PSH is a thing of the future. We do have strong support from the Oregon Society of Anesthesiology, whom I represent. We also have strong support from the Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon Medical Board, and surgeons in the community. The patient and the community of Oregon can be proud and hopefully will support this, especially since the patient is under the supervision of an anesthesiologist at all times. As an example, when I was on trauma call at Emanuel, we would more than often get multiple gunshot wounds in, or we'd get auto accidents, and basically one anesthesiologist, one patient. If an AA were on board, or more than one AA were on board in such a situation, both OHSU, Emanuel, high-risk situations, we will be able to have two or three AAs working with us, and we, the anesthesiologist, would be the supervisor of more than one case. This is great for the surgeons, great for the team, great for the patient, and it's very efficient. So consequently, I think that you might say, well, how do these AAs and CRNAs work with regard to reimbursement? There is no difference. The second thing is that the AAs and the nurse anesthetists and the anesthesiologists are what we call an anesthesia care team. We have the team approach. Team approach is everywhere in healthcare and a number of other issues in our state. It's important to know that the training of the AA is done in a medical school setting. The nurse anesthetist is trained in a nursing setting or under the auspices of a nursing program. The PA is much like the is like a physician's assistant, which we have now under the auspices of the medical board. However, the anesthesia AA is specially trained to take their last part of training under the supervision and auspices of an anesthesia care team mode, and also in a medical school setting. Currently, the new university curriculum, which is down on the waterfront in Portland, all of the basic AA, pharmacology, pre-meds all take the same courses during the first year of their training. So therefore, they are all together. They speak the same language. They've had the same curriculum, and it's an efficient way, and it seems to be a very popular way that the curriculums in healthcare are going. And I guess finally, I would say that it's the way to go. It's a wave of the future. We're going to answer issues that are pending and on the horizon, and we're calling for a strong support of this committee to support the licensure of the AA so that Michael can come back and practice in Oregon. Thank you.
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, my name is Caleb Hayes. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Society of Anesthesiologists. Taking a look through some of the testimony on OLIS, you'll see that there are quite a few comments, and many from CRNAs, against this bill. And I'd just like to point out that there are currently more of them than there are of folks like Michael here in Oregon, because of the simple fact that he cannot get licensed in Oregon as an AA. So please recognize that as you consider comments on this bill. You're going to hear that AAs are underqualified, but I'd ask you to just take a look at the facts. It's not true. Their qualifications are equal to or greater than that of CRNAs. In fact, especially if you consider the clinical training that's required to become an AA. You're also going to hear that we're flooded with anesthesia providers. However, the Oregon Anesthesia Group recently tried to hire a CRNA, and no CRNA applicants were able to make it through their entire process. So with that, please support House Bill 2295. People like Michael deserve a chance to work right here in Oregon. He is absolutely qualified to perform anesthesia. He wants to come home, and we deserve an opportunity to do that. Thank you.
Caleb, I do need to say that I heard a different story about the recruitment of a CNRA. That'll be useful to find out what actually happened.
Sure, I can share with you the letter from the HR department.
Good. Is there any questions to this panel? Thank you all very much.
Please
call the next panel.
Okay.
I think we have three more, right?
A panel of three and then two individuals. Christina Cowgill, Mary Carlett, Sean DeRemer.
Any order.
Hello.
Mention your name when you start.
Chair Greenlich, Vice Chair Knows, and Vice Chair Hayden, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christina Cowgill, and I am a certified registered nurse anesthetist, or CRNA. I'm also the Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Association of Nurse Anesthetists, ORANA. I want to thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today to speak in opposition to House Bill 2295. ORANA is a member of the American Association of Nurse Anesthetists and is celebrating 80 years as the association representing Oregon CRNAs, and currently we have over 350 members of our association representing 90% of the total CRNA population in Oregon. I just want to point out that our members feel that this matter of House Bill 2295 is very important to us, and I want to recognize that in today's hearing room and the overflow room, we have over 25 CRNAs who have come to be part of this hearing today.
We appreciate you all didn't sign up to testify.
Trying to keep it simple. I'm trying to speak on their
behalf.
We
appreciate that.
Thank you, Chair. I also want to recognize that many CRNAs have submitted written testimony lending their personal perspectives and insight for your consideration on this matter. It is truly a privilege to speak for this great association, and on behalf of all the CRNAs that sit here before you today, as well as those holding down the fort and the operating suites across the state. I am joined by Dr. Carlette, Nurse Anesthesia Program Director at OHSU, and Dr. Sean DeRemer, anesthesiologist. So to begin, I just want to let you know that Oregon does indeed have a very rich, strong history of nurses providing anesthesia for well over a century. From historical records, we actually can find an 1896 diary of Sister Moreau describing anesthesia being practiced by nurses here in Oregon. In 1909, St. Vincent Hospital opened its doors to train the first nurses to give anesthesia. That became the first facility to train nurse anesthetists in the United States. Today, OHSU continues with this strong tradition of educating CRNAs as well as educating anesthesiologists. And together, CRNAs and anesthesiologists provide 100% of the anesthesia care throughout this great state. This bill, House Bill 2295 before you, asks you to authorize yet a third anesthesia provider, an anesthesiologist assistant, or AA. While there are many significant concerns that we have to this bill, I just want to highlight two for brevity today. Number one is that AAs would not expand Oregonians' access to anesthesia services, especially in these rural settings where access to care is most needed. And two, the model of practice represented by this bill is more costly than the delivery model that we already have in place. And this more costly model is being urged upon you today, despite that there's no workforce issues that demonstrate the need to create yet another new anesthesia provider in Oregon. So regarding my first point, CRNAs and AAs are not equivalent, nor are they interchangeable. CRNAs are qualified to make independent judgments regarding all aspects of anesthesia care, and this is based on not only their education, but their licensure and their certification. While nurse anesthesia education programs graduate nurse anesthetists prepared to have a high degree of autonomy, the AA program curriculum is characterized by training those anesthesia providers to have anesthesiologists side by side with them and assist the anesthesiologist in technical functions. By training as defined in this proposed bill, AAs would have to be supervised all the time by an anesthesiologist. Well, let's consider Oregon. Approximately 80% of the top-rated critical access hospitals in the state are staffed solely by nurse anesthetists. Because AAs must be supervised by anesthesiologists, this does not expand the anesthesia access into these rural areas. There's also some key problems with the supervision model as described. In 2012, a study published in Anesthesiology by Drs. Epstein and Drs. Dexter demonstrate the risk of resulting lapses in the supervision model. According to this study, the number of operating rooms that an anesthesiologist can supervise is limited by the probability that two or more simultaneous events will not occur. So it's a very reasonable question to ask whether an anesthesiologist can safely be available to multiple assistants. There are many times when an anesthesiologist is unavailable to one AA because the anesthesiologist may be helping an AA in a different operating room. This leaves a substantial probability that the AA may be alone when an emergency occurs. This study clearly demonstrates that the consequences to requiring supervision will not only result in case delays in the operating room, which is a huge factor in efficiencies in the hospital, but more alarmingly, that this could actually put a threat to patient safety. To expect or demand that an anesthesiologist can be in four places at once, it's unrealistic, especially considering the work setting of surgery, where mishaps can happen, and if they happen, a patient's life is hanging in the balance, and this is when seconds do count. So from the findings of this particular study in 2012, from the lack of further studies on supervision, and the realities of the high-paced and fast demands of the operating room, all these counsel in favor of a more stringent ratio than that found currently in this bill. Perhaps a 1-to-2 ratio, at least that would better safeguard our patients' population. To my second point, this bill actually asks you to endorse a more costly care model. There are nearly equal numbers of anesthesiologists and nurse anesthetists throughout the country. And Oregon is able to attract and retain both types of these providers. We currently train both of them here, as I testified to earlier. We train them both at OHSU. And it is a real loss that after receiving their education here in this great state, they leave to find employment elsewhere. More fundamentally, the cost of anesthesia provided by two professionals, the AA and the anesthesiologist, is more costly than the provided by just one. It's a higher cost to the facility, yes, the patient and the insurance company and the community. I did have four highlights of the bill that we found very, very troubling. Did you want me to go over those?
Very quickly,
thank
please.
You. I would like to address the troubling language here. And number one is the scope of practice. The proposed bill before you does not delineate a scope of practice for the AA. When the AA bill was introduced unsuccessfully in 2013, it was a Senate Bill 630, it did include that scope of practice, and we feel that a delineated scope of practice is essential when licensing a new provider. Number two is the supervision. The proposed bill before you does not define what supervision means, and in the unsuccessful 2013 bill, although there was no clear definition of supervision, it did state that an anesthesiologist must supervise AAs in a manner that's consistent with federal regulations for reimbursement. Number three is the troubling supervision ratio. Under House Bill 2295 before you, an anesthesiologist who is not part of an organization can supervise up to four individuals. If there's an anesthesiologist organization, however, there's no limits to how many AAs that they can supervise. In the 2013 bill, there was clear language regarding supervision limits, even though we do believe that this limit was set far too high. And fourth and final is the temporary license and inactive license language in this bill. Under House Bill 2295, the Board of Medicine could issue a temporary license to a practicing AA who's not even completed their board examination. The general trend in the United States is to not allow this type of licensure for any provider. Secondly, the anesthesiologist who has an inactive license, according to this bill, has up to 5 years to reactivate that license without being held to any additional certifying exam or additional education. And again, that type of licensure does not protect the public for provider competence. So in conclusion, given the lack of data showing workforce demand for a new type of provider here in Oregon, and due to the limited scope and the higher cost of adopting this model, I urge you to oppose this bill, and I stand in line with some of our other opponents of this bill, including the Oregon Nurses Association. Thank you for your time, and we're available for questions.
Thank you. Next, please.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Carlett. I'm a CRNA. I have a master's degree in nurse anesthesia from Wayne State University in Detroit, Michigan, and I have a PhD in physiology from Wayne State as well. As the director of our state's nurse anesthesia program at OHSU, I would like to highlight 3 points today about nurse anesthesia education. My first point is our application requirements. All of our applicants are registered nurses with Bachelor of Science degrees. In addition, they have at least 1 year of critical care experience. Most of our applicants have over 2 years of critical care experience as an RN. This means that our students typically have significant experience caring for seriously ill patients and developing needed critical thinking skills even before they enter our program. My second point is our nurse anesthesia education. The OHSU Nurse Anesthesia Program is a graduate program, full-time, 27 months, and it awards a master's degree from OHSU School of Nursing. It is an intense science-based curriculum with rigorous clinical education. Our students rotate to large community hospitals in Portland, like OHSU, Kaiser Permanente, but they also rotate to small, rural, critical access hospitals in Oregon, places like Gold Beach and Hermiston. My third point is where our graduates work. Our graduates are prepared to work in any setting in Oregon, in a team setting certainly with anesthesiologists, but they are equally prepared to work safely as sole anesthesia providers. Most importantly, many of our graduates work in traditionally underserved areas of our state in rural Oregon, including critical access hospitals and all CRNA practices. Our graduates work as sole anesthesia providers in Grants Pass, Hermiston, Newport, Newburgh, Silverton, Hood River, and other rural locations. Finally, I would like to add today that this past summer, the Oregon Anesthesiology Group approached our nurse anesthesia program, requesting that we invite our graduates to apply for newly adopted CRNA positions in their group. I am hopeful that OAG pursues this path so that they can work with the safe and time-tested CRNAs who are already here in our state. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the House Healthcare Committee, I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak in opposition of House Bill 2295.
Your name, please.
My name is Dr. Sean Michael DeRemer, and I am the President and Executive Medical Director of Anesthesia Associates Northwest, based in Portland, Oregon. AANW is presently the largest employer of certified registered nurse anesthetists in the state of Oregon, employing well over 100 CRNAs in addition to anesthesiologists. While House Bill 2295 has been couched in part as a bill to address a workforce problem in the Oregon anesthesia community or market, it's important for the committee to understand there's not a workforce shortage with respect to CRNAs or anesthesiologists in Oregon. AANW has recruited and engaged over 40 CRNAs in the last 12 months. In each and every instance, we have posted a CRNA position to be filled and have had well over 15 qualified, experienced CRNAs apply for a single position. We've had the luxury of picking the most qualified or experienced CRNAs from a large pool of applicants. In several instances, we have had over 30 individuals apply for a single job. Definitively, there is no shortage of CRNAs hoping to gain employment in Oregon in light of the fact that we have turned away dozens of hopeful candidates in the recent past. The same predicate holds true for our anesthesiologists, although we have not recruited nearly as many in the last 12 months. OHU has a training program for both anesthesiologists and CRNAs, like we have heard. Approximately 50% of those CRNAs annually graduate from OHSU training program are not able to gain employment in the state of Oregon and are forced to seek job opportunities in other regions and or in other places in the country. We're routinely contacted by these graduates and rarely have work for them as a result of our access to a large pool of highly experienced, qualified CRNAs. Anyone who actually stands before this committee and suggests that there is a shortage of anesthesia providers wishing or willing to come to Oregon is simply not being forthright, or they are attempting to recruit candidates to a subpar work environment or inferior compensatory arrangements relative to geographic and or industry standards.
We have a tradition in the legislature not to impugn other people's motives, so I think it would be useful if
sure.
you stick to
okay.
positive side of this.
Absolutely. We have not encountered any workforce shortages or recruitment issues with respect to CRNAs or anesthesiologists anywhere in Oregon at our client facilities. In the absence of organizational and our workplace inadequacies, there exists no workforce shortage for anesthesia providers in Oregon, and our recent recruitment history definitively underscores this fact. Endorsing House Bill 2295 has a significant implication relating to CRNA practice in Oregon. This legislation will increase the cost of anesthesia care to Oregonians, have a negative net impact on anesthesia access, and while attempting to supplant CRNAs currently in the workforce, will denigrate the anesthesia market with a redundancy of less qualified providers. Again, as we've spoken before, they're unable to practice independently. Anesthesia assistants are unable to practice independently and represent an unnecessary redundancy of providers caring for a single patient. thereby directly increasing costs. Crafting any legislation which allows anesthesiologists to supervise anesthesia assistants in ratios exceeding 1-to-1 simply promotes scenarios whereby anesthesiologists are physically unable to be immediately available to AAs for all critical portions of any surgical procedure. Any attempt to circumvent this strict statute lends itself to gross inefficiencies in the workplace and is the antithesis or the antithesis of customer service in this current healthcare climate. Finally, many states have turned away from anesthesia assistants by virtue of their lack of healthcare experience, abbreviated training, limited scope of practice, increased costs, and an inability to improve patient access, service lines, and geographical regions. For the aforementioned reasons, this iteration of provider is not a viable option for our nation's future anesthesia needs, but rather an ASA initiative driven by a desire to supplant over a century of vetted high-quality care rendered by our certified registered nurse anesthetists, a valuable anesthesia resource that is neither in short supply nor lacking in the willingness to serve our communities in a cost-conscious fashion. In fact, our collaborative care team model can be delivered to this marketplace at 65% of the cost of an MD-only anesthesia practice, while substantially improving access, efficiency, and customer service across all communities and service lines. In closing, I'd like to reiterate that as a board-certified anesthesiologist, I've worked collaboratively with my CRNA colleagues for over 17 years under some of the most demanding circumstances the industry has to offer. Our team approach to complex clinical scenarios has continued to exceed the expectations of our patients while yielding quality outcomes that are undisputed in the literature. I implore you to thoroughly consider the impact this potential legislation will have on the practice of our CRNA colleagues who have expertly provided high-quality, cost-effective anesthesia care to our state for more than a century. Please carefully consider the impact of this bill on the cost, access, and quality of health care in our state. Thank you.
Are there any questions to this panel?
Yes.
Thank you, Chair Greenleaf. I'm puzzled why, on one hand, you say this would be more expensive because of a one-to-one ratio, but on the other hand, you're concerned about quality because they're supervising several AAs. Seems like an inconsistency.
Well, Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, the inconsistency is that it's multifaceted. The ability to be able to oversee or supervise more than one anesthesia assistant by statute in this state disallows the anesthesiologist to do that in critical portions of the case when more than one critical incident is occurring at any one particular point in time. So their ability to supervise more than one person, in the truest sense of the term, is not physically or legitimately possible if there are critical incidences. And I'm here to tell you there are critical issues that happen all the time in the operating room, which I'm certain that you're aware of. From a cost standpoint, any time we double up on anesthesia providers, if we had to have a 1-to-1 or a 1-to-2 ratio, and some of the things that have been talked about in terms of the salaries of anesthesia assistants being on par with those of nurse anesthetists who are reimbursed handsomely for what they do, in that scenario, you're doubling up on providers, and you're creating a duplicity of anesthesia care, which is more costly.
Why would anyone want to do that? They're not going to. I have a hard time believing that. Why would anyone want to do that? They're not going to get reimbursed more for that case. They're more than capable of doing the case by themselves. Why would they want to add another person if they're not going to be able to supervise?
Because the intent is to not supervise that ratio. The intent is to supervise a much greater ratio.
Well, certainly, and I don't think anyone's hiding behind that. If you do that, then you're not going to increase the cost.
You're not going to increase the cost, but you're going to compromise safety and you're going to compromise patient care because you're talking about. Not having oversight to a provider who, by statute, is forced to have oversight.
Follow-up question. Is there any evidence to justify that? The study that was quoted was a projection of a model. Is there any scientific evidence? It's a randomized study that shows that AAs will produce more complications.
There is evidence to support that independent CRNA practice in the state of Oregon has...
That wasn't my question. Is there any evidence that AAs will produce a higher complication or provide a safety risk than in the published literature. I'm not talking about CRNAs. With CRNAs, have great confidence in their skills. That's not the question.
Chair Greenlight, Representative Bueller, there is no evidence to support that you would have higher complications, nor is there evidence to support that the independent unsupervised practice is a valuable utilization of this type of third-tier provider.
We're not talking about unsupervised.
We are when we're speaking of ratios greater than 1-to-1, we are absolutely talking about unsupervised providers. Yes, sir, we are.
I just want to announce we are going to, I'll do it officially in a bit, but we are going to carry over 2605 if you're waiting to testify on that.
Chair Greenlee, just quick question. And this might be a step back. I do understand that the CRNA and the AA programs are separate licensure. If you give me a little background, maybe for the committee, if an AA that's certified from the example of somebody in Georgia came and wanted to enter the program for the CRNA program, would they get any credit transfer in that education? Is there a mechanism for them to be fast-tracked, or do they basically have to start from ground zero and go through the entire program?
Representative Greenlick, Representative Hayden, the nurse anesthesia programs all admit registered nurses, and they all have a bachelor's degree, and they all must have at least 1 year of critical care experience as an RN. And so by virtue of the fact that AAs do not, by requirement, have any previous healthcare experience, they're certainly not RNs, mm-hmm. and they have no required healthcare education, then we could not fast-track them into a nurse anesthesia program.
Okay. We'll call the next panel. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can we call the next two witnesses?
Chris and Steve Bledsoe.
Can I ask you to be very, very brief, please?
Will do.
We've got a whole big panel after you in the next half an hour.
Good afternoon, Chairman Greenlake, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Bledsoe. I'm a physician, and I'm a board-certified anesthesiologist, and I'm a longstanding member of the Oregon Society of Anesthesiologists. And I'm here to oppose House Bill 2295 for the simple reason that I don't think it adds safety or a decrease in cost for the anesthesia care for the patients in Oregon State. Very simply, I've been an anesthesiologist for 25 years. I served in a major inner-city hospital in Seattle for 16 years, doing general and a specialty in neuroanesthesia. 8 years ago, I came to McMinnville, where for the last 8 years, I've served as a general anesthesiologist, chairman of the anesthesia department, and I've worked with a fabulous crew of 3 physician anesthesiologists and 5 CRNAs in perfect collaboration. My training to get to this point cost me 8 years after undergraduate school, 4 years medical school, 4 years of residency. Our CRNAs with whom I have worked have been registered nurses, typically with multiple years of clinical experience, typically with multiple years of critical care experience, even before they enter their 2 to 3 years of training. The AA class of anesthesia provider proposed in this bill has no clinical experience. They come to a program, they get 1 year of science training beyond their undergraduate, and then 1 heavy year of clinical training, and that's all. And as a result, nowhere in this country are they allowed to practice unsupervised. In fact, there are only 13 states in the entire country that license AAs. There are only 10 AA training centers in the entire United States. There are 114 centers that train CRNAs. In fact, our small hospital in McMinnville is one of the critical access hospitals that trains OHSU's CRNAs. What are we left with? AAs, as a class of providers, have much less training than the people already licensed in the state. They cannot work without supervision, so they cannot provide critical rural access care. There's no evidence of the quality of their training. There's no evidence that their care is any worse, just as you've already been over. We do not, as has been stated many times, we do not have a shortage of anesthesia providers. There's no need to create a new class. They will not save health care costs. For every AA working, there has to be at least one anesthesiologist also working on that same case. So costs go up, no evidence of improved care. I see no value. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Yes, please.
My sole criteria, well, actually, I have a couple of...
Introduce yourself.
My name is Chris Bledsoe, and this is my spouse, Stephen Bledsoe, and I help support him through medical school residency, and I am a clinically trained hospital chaplain, and I have served at three hospitals in that capacity. And I'm here to talk as an advocate for the patients, because what I see in the hospital is the patients are, as you all would be, very, very apprehensive before you go into surgery. Whether it's minor or major, you're apprehensive. Now imagine, if you will, that you find out that the anesthesiologist who you may have met or who you assume is providing your care is not going to be in the room. And they say, well, the person in the room will be a technician who has some training in anesthesia. I won't be in the room. What do I think as a patient? I think, well, what happens if something goes wrong? Well, they'll get there. Well, how soon will they get there? Will they get there in time? And this is very stressful. You have to understand, and I'm sure you do, the stress adds to the well-being and the outcome of surgery. The calmer the patient is, the more likely they are to recover quickly. I don't have the studies to prove that, but because I'm not a researcher. I know that from experience, and I'm sure anybody you would talk to who works with patients knows that that is the case. As a chaplain, I have to deal with staff, and I can tell you that the staff at Willamette Valley Medical Center, the CRNAs at Willamette Valley Medical Center, I would willingly go under the knife with them at my head. They are capable, they're trained, they instill confidence when they interact with the patients, the surgeons like working with them, and it would be interesting to me to hear what surgeons think about working with AAs. We're just now getting to the point where the surgeons understand that the CRNAs are capable. You start throwing in AAs in the room, and the surgeons are not going to be happy. So, I would like to address, and I'm sorry I didn't address the committee correctly, Chair Greenlich, and I would like to address one question that was brought up by Representative Bueller, because my background is in economics. And I would like to address the fact that one of the...
Representative Bueller's background is in surgery. So.
And also economics.
Okay, so we've got a good match going here. Is to answer the question about the financial, because I understand the question. If you have an anesthesiologist supervising two, possibly three AAs, those procedures are billed at the same rate as it would be if there was an anesthesiologist in the room, and they're compensated the same way.
We really need to cut this short.
Okay, I am answering this question, if you may, just like you said, so that the cost is the same to the medical insurance company and to the patient, but in fact, it's the anesthesiologist who is then making three times the amount of money that he would have made if he had only been in one room. So you follow the money on that, if you will. So thank you very much for your time.
I'm going to ask you to finish.
Questions of us?
No, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2295. As I said before, I'm going to announce formally House Bill 2605 will be carried over till Friday. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2758. And is Representative Williamson here?
Not yet.
She'll be here in a minute. Is she on her way?
Okay. Mr.
Who else?
There she is.
What do we have, please?
Did you open the public hearing yet?
I did.
Okay. Mr. Chair, House Bill 2758 prohibits a carrier or a third-party administrator from disclosing to a person other than the enrollee who receives the sensitive services information relating to the sensitive services that were provided to the enrollee.
Will you call the first panel, including Representative Williamson?
It is Representative Williamson, Laura Terrell Patton, and Lorena Reynolds.
Thank you. We've got about 25 minutes, so only this bill, so let's keep it.
All right.
As much time as you need, but not any more.
I hear you loud and clear, Mr. Chair. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you for hearing this bill today. I'm Jennifer Williamson. I'm the state representative for House District 36, which is downtown Northwest and Southwest Portland. And I'm also, for the purposes of this bill, I'm a board member of Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon and have been for a very long time. So what you have in front of you, you should be getting handed out from staff an example of an explanation of benefits. Everybody's gotten these. They usually say this is not a bill on the top of them. So I wanted to make sure that everybody had one in front of them when we started talking about this bill. What's usually on them? The patient's name. So the person who received the medical services. Their ID number, their claim number, who their provider was, the type of service.
The COB goes to.
Well, I'm getting there. We're jumping ahead. I'm building the suspense.
I'm helping you. I'm just trying to help you.
So type of service, date of service, charge. You know, we've all seen these. What this bill addresses is the fact that this explanation of benefits and all of the information goes to the policyholder, not the patient. And this is an issue, and why I'm so passionate about this bill is I have a 21-year-old stepdaughter. I'm the policyholder in the family. I get a printout of every medical service that she receives. Now, our policy in my house is I shred them. I don't open them. Because I think as a 21-year-old young woman, it is none of my business what medical treatment she's seeking if she chooses not to tell me. She may tell her dad, she may tell her mom, but as her stepmom, she gets to own that personal information. And so this bill, the intent of this bill is to allow patient privacy and protection around sensitive services where the policy holder would not get an explanation of benefit statement for certain services. This issue has become even more important since the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, because young people up to 26 years old can be on their parents' health insurance. Now, they may not be living with them, who knows what the relationship is with their parents, but that, because we've expanded that so that up to 26-year-olds can be on their parents' health insurance, those patients who most of us would consider adults after 18, their medical information is going to their parents. And this is not only a privacy issue, but it's a safety issue as well. Because if you're seeking services, mental health services, services for domestic violence, and your explanation of benefits goes to your spouse, who may be your abuser, the fact that you're seeking treatment or help may actually put you at risk. And so, colleagues, I know you'll hear later about some issues that we need to work through in this bill. I'm committed to working through issues to make this the best bill we can possibly make. But I wanted to be here to kick this off because I care so much about this bill and this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sorry the timing got all messed up.
It's okay.
It's never happened before, right?
Who's next?
Chair Greenlink and members of the House Healthcare Committee. My name is Laura Terrell Patton. I'm the Executive Director of Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon. Thank you for having me here today. Apologies for not submitting my testimony in advance. We've been engaged in some great conversations around this bill, and my testimony just became finalized. As the policy voice for Planned Parenthood in Oregon, patient privacy is at the forefront of our work. People come to our health centers because they know they'll be cared for compassionately and confidentially and receive the highest quality care. As Oregon moves forward with healthcare reform, it is critical to prioritize patient confidentiality. States that have the opportunity to address new confidentiality concerns and to enhance patient access to care by implementing steps to prevent unwanted disclosure of personal information. Strong protections around confidentiality will ensure all members can access and use the healthcare they need. Oregon law needs to close a loophole in insurance communications to strengthen privacy and increase access to health care. Numerous protections are in place to protect patient privacy on the front end of a patient visit, and we want to make sure that that protection is provided to them on the back end of their visit as well. Without protections for privacy, some folks are going effectively uninsured. We've heard many stories about patients who delay or choose not to receive care because they are afraid their confidentiality will be compromised in insurance communications. Just last week at one of our health centers, a young man came in who was incredibly uncomfortable. He was screened for a particular STD. He was encouraged to get a full screening because there was a concern that he had more than one ailment afflicting him. And he admitted to his provider that he was paying for the visit out of pocket because he didn't want his parents to know. And he couldn't afford to go through the full STD screening, and he left without receiving the care that he needed. We've heard stories about students in college who want to receive care for addiction services, eating disorders, and don't want their parents to know that they are in that trauma. And again, these folks are effectively being rendered uninsured and incurring a great amount of debt in the process, and debt that their insurance policy should be paying for. House Bill 2758 will address these concerns by requiring carriers to send insurance communications directly to the member receiving the services, not the primary policyholder, unless the member receiving that care consents to those communications being directed in that way. We look forward to working with the insurance division and carriers to operationalize these protections, just as it is standard practice for a patient to confirm their billing address and contact information at point of service. We are pursuing a system that will also confirm their preferred method of contact regarding their insurance communications. House Bill 2758 includes a provision that requires a standardized form across all insurers for enrollees to either provide their alternative address or consent to the address on file. Any bill that affects insurance companies and interactions with Oregonians deserves a lot of discussion and broad involvement. We are really proud to say that we've done just that. We brought this bill to a wide variety of providers, including Cambia, Providence, LifeWise, and Kaiser, and experts in the field of public health. We've engaged in conversations over the past few months with the insurance commissioner and her staff, and we've asked about enforcement and implementation within the insurance division staff and the carriers. We're proud of the work that we've put in, and we're appreciative of the division and the commissioner for engaging and providing their feedback. Everyone at the table agrees that confidentiality is an issue and are open to finding solutions. We took the feedback that we received seriously, and we are particularly appreciative of Cambia's involvement in these conversations. It is in the spirit of that collaboration and compromise that we are offering an amendment to the bill with our chief sponsors, Representative Williamson and Senator Burdick. The language has been submitted to Ledge Council, but I'd like to just quickly go over them. At the insurer's request, we are changing sensitive services to all services. Insurance carriers informed us that it would be easier to operationalize if it was an across-the-board process and not just for a subset of the services as the original bill indicated. We heard those concerns and agree that this will improve the bill. Upon feedback and request from the insurance providers, we're also removing the $25,000 fine and change the enforcement determined through already existing fines outlined in civil penalties, and OEID has the authority to implement those if needed. We're also removing the 90-day effective date and changing the immediate effective date, changing to an immediate effective date with a delayed operative date of January 1, 2016 to allow the insurance division to get working on this, but also give the providers time to operationalize. We are also adding an exemption for the Department of Corrections at their request, so the bill does not apply to inmate information and services. And finally, from direct feedback, we are adding in a section that says that nothing described in this bill shall be interpreted as conflicting with federal laws or regulations. So that's a lot of changes. We look forward to getting that language in front of you. We are pleased to be able to compromise on this bill and make it a better bill for Oregonians, and look forward to continuing to engage in conversations to ensure that patient medical information is kept private. Again, we believe it'll be a better bill and ensure confidentiality and insurance communications. Thank you for your time, and we're obviously happy to answer questions.
Well, let's move on, and then we'll ask questions. I read the bill. I don't see how the Department of Corrections are involved in this bill at all, so I assume making it clear they're not would be helpful. But
Chair Greenlick, they would be considered third-party administrators. Right. And so they need to receive the billing for and the explanation of benefits.
But they would automatically receive the billing. This wouldn't stop it. This relates to the EOB, mm-hmm. which is, anyway, if we make clear they're excluded, that's mm-hmm. fine. Yes, go ahead.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Lorena Reynolds. I'm a private attorney in Corvallis, and I specialize in family law. I handle many cases involving intimate partner violence. Because of my experience working with survivors of domestic violence, sexual abuse and assault, and stalking, I support the House Bill 2758 to increase the safety for survivors of violence and allow them greater access to services. This bill will strengthen privacy for survivors who seek services relating to their abuse. Many survivors have health insurance that is provided to them through the employment of a family member. Sometimes this is the very person who has abused them. Other times it is a parent, step-parent, or spouse who is unaware of the abuse and who the survivor may not want to know of that abuse. As it stands now, whenever a survivor seeks mental health or medical care, the EOB statement is sent to the person who holds the insurance policy, not to the person seeking services. This has at least two negative effects. Survivors who are aware that the policyholder will be informed that they sought services sometimes don't seek services because of this. If a woman has contracted a sexually transmitted infection or is pregnant as a result of being sexually assaulted, she may delay obtaining prenatal care or medical services. Teenagers and young adults may choose not to seek medical care or seek counseling because they don't want their parent, step-parent, or guardian to know of the abuse. Someone assaulted by a spouse who holds the insurance may not go to the emergency room or urgent care for treatment of injuries because they fear further abuse by their spouse when the EOB arrives and the abuser finds out that they sought medical services. Second, lack of confidentiality endangers survivors who are unaware of the policyholder will be informed of the services that they are seeking. EOBs contain information that can be used to locate a survivor. For example, if a survivor regularly sees a counselor each week, the policyholder can see this pattern on the EOB. For survivors in hiding, this is a barrier to accessing services. It is also common for abusers to then use this information to try to access additional information from the counselor, to harass the counselor, or to intercept a survivor on her way to the appointment. I have personally been involved in cases where a child was in counseling as the result of abuse by a parent who then received information about the counseling services from the EOB that was sent to their home. This includes treatment codes and information about the child's diagnoses, even though the parent was prohibited from having contact with the child or accessing the child's records in other ways. Many teens live in households that blame them for being sexually abused or assaulted. Sometimes when a parent finds out about abuse from a third party, the repercussions at home can include additional violence in addition to shaming and emotional abuse. Teens often do not realize that the EOBs will be sent to the policyholder if they seek treatment. House Bill 2758 will require carriers to send insurance communications directly to the member rather than to the primary policyholder. As we move forward with health care reform and the digitalization of medical information, it is critical to remember that for many insured patients, this lack of confidentiality protections is the same as a lack of insurance. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Are there questions at this time? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sitting here having troubles grasping this because, I have a very firm grasp of it because I do have an 18 and 19-year-old and a 26 and 29-year-old. The thing is, my 18 and 19-year-old are both boys and they're not very responsible. One's diabetic. One's being tested for Crohn's and lots of other things. If the bill comes in their name, my wife's still opening that bill. Anything that comes in, she's opening it. Doesn't matter whose name's on it. She's going to open it, period, if it's delivered to the house. I'm the one responsible for the bill, so, and I've had stuff that gets lost because we fight PEB all the time. I mean, it's every invoice that comes. It's like it's a big fight with them to get them to pay, even when they've preferred, said go to this provider, you go to that provider, and it's not there. So who's going to accept that responsibility? So say my daughter goes and I don't have a daughter, but I'll do this hypothetically. I have a daughter and I'm abusing her and everything, and she's going to counseling. The bill comes in her name. It's still going to be opened by my wife. So how is this going to help?
Well, this isn't the bill. This is the explanation of benefits. So the billing is going to be handled directly with the provider. The explanation of benefits is how much the insurance company is going to be paid. And so when you go in to see your counselor, for example...
It's the same issue he's raising.
When you go in to see
it the... maybe address his daughter, but somebody else in the family is...
But when you go in to see your counselor, you're going to be signing up with your own address. So if you don't live at home,
address. His perspective is if you do live at home, then it could be opened by anybody if it's coming.
It could be, but it would be coming in her name. And if she's living at home and she's having her... If your bill is going to come in the child's name to the address that they designate. But even if right now, the way it is, even if you designate that that bill should be sent to the survivor directly...
Actually,
the EOB would still go to the policyholder, regardless of her wishes.
Yes.
He doesn't pay the bill. Who are they going to call? Me.
But for many of these survivors, they do pay their own bills.
Can we move on? We have some more witnesses to talk to you.
Quickly. I appreciate you bringing this to our attention. I certainly see this as a problem. I think there's... As we're alluding to, there may be more complexity here, so I encourage you to hear this this out, because I think there may be other problems that show up.
I think we need to move on. We have 5 minutes more, and we have six more witnesses, near as I can make out. Can we get the panel, please, now that are unopposed, and see if you can consolidate your testimony if it's all the same? Would you call? I think we have four people.
Jessica Adamson, Lisa Trussell, Elizabeth Remley.
And Tom Holt on that as well?
No, well, it was actually Elizabeth.
All right. Let's go.
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, Elizabeth Remley here for Cambia. I would like to clarify that we're actually in support of the bill. We support the concept, and we are completely sympathetic to what Planned Parenthood is trying to do. Cambia does have a process in place to change the address of an EOB for survivors of domestic violence, messy divorces, and a few other things. We'd be happy to facilitate opening that up to other folks. We think that it's important for people to feel that they have privacy on the back end of any of these services as the EOB is coming to them.
Is it your position that it'd be easier just to do it for all EOBs rather than for a particular one?
It absolutely would be easier to do it for every service provided to a particular patient. We have some administrative concerns about the way the bill is written. We would like to have some time to talk to Planned Parenthood about it. We've been working with them for about 3 weeks. We appreciate that they came to us. We appreciate that they asked us for our input. We did provide it, and we need to continue to work with them to make sure that we can actually facilitate this in a way that won't add several full-time employees and lots of administrative costs to our administration.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of Providence Health and Services, both as a provider and an insurer. We are sadly here in opposition to the bill as written. We have worked through our colleagues at Cambia on this bill and with them offered amendments that would get us to a place where, like Cambia, we share the concern about privacy, and we are eager to work with the proponents to develop a mechanism to make sure that patients, I have a 19-year-old, if he doesn't want explanation of benefits coming home, fine by me, that he can opt in to a process to make that happen. As we understand the proponents' proposal to date, we have significant concerns about the administrative aspect. And I want to speak right now as a provider of services, as one that operates numerous clinics and hospitals around the state. As we understand the proposal, the goal is to have providers at the point of service seek information as to where the patient would like the explanation of benefit sent, and then create a new process by which we provide that information to the payer. That puts us in the middle of a relationship between the patient and the provider, the patient and the payer, with respect to that explanation of benefit statement. That information is not going to payers today, would require a significant adjustment in our processes and an administrative burden that we think is unhelpful, certainly costly. We are anxious to work with them to find a mechanism to allow patients to receive that information separately, but to do so in a way that doesn't create a new burden. So for us, again, on the underlying concept, absolutely supportive. The way that it's written today, not productive, but we are committed to continuing to be at the table to try and find a solution that we can all feel good about.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lisa Trussell with HealthNet Health Plans of Oregon, also here in opposition to the bill, particularly as written. I won't go over the administrative complexities. They've already done that. But a couple of things that jump out is that this isn't limited in it by any means to a specific age group. This is saying that everybody gets a separate one. I concur with your comments. My kids, they living under my roof. Mama's opening the mail. So if you want to get your mail somewhere else, move out. But we already have.
Just where you get rid of them. Huh?
Yeah.
I'm going to try that.
But I'll stop my answer.
I found charging them rent got rid of them.
Yeah. But we already, and I think that we're not unique. I believe all of the carriers, we all have policies and procedures in place for people, for the very reasons that were explained by the proponents, to have their EOBs mailed somewhere else. In my opinion, the issue is not that we don't have that procedure in place. The issue is that the young person who's showing up for treatment at a provider doesn't know. And mailing them a letter from their insurance company that they may or may not ever see to opt out, I think you could do more with a billboard or some posters in the provider's office saying you have the right to have this mailed to someone other than your mom and dad.
I think we hear this, so yeah. Keep working. Let's see if we can get to someplace. I really want to get the last two witnesses in.
Thanks.
And I appreciate the fact that you guys are working together on this one. See if we can get to a good conclusion. Who are the last two witnesses?
Lori Trieger and Sarah Keefe.
Please, I'm sorry. We have to ask you to be brief. We were supposed to be out of the room in 2 minutes. We can be a little late.
Chair Greenlick, representatives, and members of the committee, my name is Sarah Keefe.
and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. And I'm another voice here to just point at the critical importance of this legislation. I'm here in support of this bill to make sure that survivors of domestic violence can safely access care for themselves and their children. I don't want to repeat points that have already been made, but this is particularly an issue for our most vulnerable survivors who are leaving or escaping situations where they are moving from that point of home. This is also particularly a concern with new legislation under the Affordable Care Act. Screening for domestic violence and counseling for domestic violence is now a core women's preventive health service. So now medical care providers and health systems are providing more services to survivors. So there's more opportunities for that information to get out in ways that are inappropriate or a safety issue. So we really, I'm really encouraged to hear that Planned Parenthood and insurers are working together on this, because this is a grave concern, and we have seen this pop up across the country where abusive partners have tracked down survivors because of explanation of benefits letters. So I really encourage the committee to help fix this on behalf of survivors.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the House Healthcare Committee. My name is Laurie Trieger from Eugene. I'm here to speak to you today as a parent in support of this bill. I have two adult children, ages 24 and 28 years old, and I know that growing up and raising children can be fraught with challenges. Over the years, we've had many difficult conversations in our house on topics ranging from school and work-related stress to relationships and communication styles to the more generalized my body and my mind are changing fast and life is confusing talks. I'm also quite concerned, or excuse me, I'm quite certain that there were many things that we did not discuss in our household, and that's okay. What would not be okay for me ever is if one of my children unnecessarily delayed or went without needed medical attention. Whether someone's struggling with their weight or body image, they have questions about sexuality or contraception, or they're concerned over a lump or a rash and they want to have it examined, we have to remove any barriers to their receiving required and desired medical care. The order in which healthcare needs are addressed could be compromised if one is concerned information might be shared in a manner or a time that that individual deems less than ideal for their own needs. Our son was on our insurance for his 4 years through college, and he remained on our policy until recently when he was eligible to receive full medical and dental benefits through his own employer.
Yay!
Even after he had moved out and was living in another state, I was receiving EOBs for his care. This was an unnecessary breach of his confidentiality. My children's right to privacy in their medical treatment outweighs any rights I may have to know about details of insurance claims. At the time one enrolls in an insurance program as the primary policy holder, whether a parent, a spouse, or other, one already understands and agrees that another household member or family member may seek health care services under that policy. I firmly believe, however, that the details regarding the nature of those health care services should be made available only to the individual receiving the services. Without legally protected assurances of privacy, health insurance becomes a benefit you can't use. No one should feel impeded in their path to accessing needed care due to looming concern or even an outright threat hanging over them that another individual will be privy to confidential medical information simply by virtue of their being the one who holds the insurance policy. Thank you for your careful consideration and your time today and for your support of House Bill 2758.
Thank you very much. Can I ask the Department of Corrections representative?
Steve.
Are you fairly comfortable the amendments will take care of your problem? Okay, because we don't have to call you then. Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you very much. I close the public hearing on House Bill 2758, and we are adjourned.
On which one? On which one?
Adjourned.